The Future Proof Podcast from News Talk.
Proudly supported by Science Foundation Ireland. Hashtag believe in science.
Hello and welcome to Future Proof the Podcast. This is the show where we take a closer look at the world around us. My name is Jonathan McRae. A quick thank you to all of our podcast listeners. We managed to get a look at some podcast figures this week. And obviously, it's a lot to do with the situation we're in, but a huge amount of you listening, perhaps for the first time, but absolute surge in digital listens to the show. So thank you very much for those. And if you do like what you hear, we always appreciate you letting people know, subscribing to the podcast, rating it as amazing would be great. We really appreciate all those things. They do make a difference, believe it or not. Coming up on this week's episode, emotion. We're going to be talking about why we experience them, why are they so important for our relationships, and why do they get us to do such crazy things? And do animals experience them in the same way? First, though, it's time to look back at the week's science news, as we always do. Joining me via the power of Skype are double Dr. Laura Dungan, immunologist and medical doctor, and Dr. Shane Bergen from UCD. You're both very welcome. Our first story.
Our position's correct, except no Alderaan.
What do you mean? Where is it?
So I'm trying to tell you, kid, it ain't there. It's totally blown away.
What? How?
Our first story is about exoplanets, Shane. And this is about gaining one and losing one.
Yeah, so beyond, well, depending on who you ask, we have eight planets in our solar system. But beyond the solar system, we know of around 4,000 exoplanets, so planets that go around distant stars. And just recently, we've kind of gained one and lost one. Let me talk about the good one first. So you remember back in 2016, Jonathan, that on this program, we talked about the discovery of Proxima B, a planet that's going around Alpha Centauri, which is really close in space terms. It's only 4.2 light years away. And great efforts were made to try and take a photograph of it. So the way that we detect exoplanets is very, very, suppose it's really looking for a signal amongst the noise. And so they look for the wobble of a star caused by the gravitational pull of the planet. So it really is a very fine measurement. But they've been trying to take an image of an actual photograph of an exoplanet. And they started by looking at Proxima B because it's close, but it was just, it just wasn't the right candidate. But they knew that there was another planet in that system, Proxima C. And they have recently been able to take a very grainy photograph of it. Now, this has been spoken about this week in the literature, and I should stress this is not peer reviewed. But hey, with all the COVID stuff going on and most of that not being peer reviewed, I think the physicists are feeling, why should we have to go through the peer review process for our science?
Let's not turn science into the wild, wild west, Shane.
Yeah, and I actually think that's really important at the moment, that we stick to our peer review principles and we make sure that we're like, and that's what they're doing at the moment. So they're going through all of this data and the scientists themselves are skeptical and they're saying, we reckon there might be, this might be a real image, but we're not 100% sure. Because
why would it be such a big deal to publish this image? By the way, you can see this picture on our Twitter page. It's News Talk Science on Twitter.
Because it's the first actual photograph of a planet outside of our solar system. Right. So it's a visual image, and that's incredible. And they've used the really well-named Very Large Telescope in Chile to image it. But they're worried that it might just be a reflection from dust going around the star.
But these images, it's kind of like when someone gives you proof of an alien spacecraft flying over Nevada. Like, from a scientific point of view, what's the point of a visual, grainy, blurry dot that could be dust?
Well, I suppose what you would say is that if you're able to observe an object in space using lots of different techniques, you can tell an awful lot about its composition. So if you're able to collect light from this planet, even though it's very grainy, first of all, you can show that you can do it in principle. And then you go and you get a higher resolution image. And from that, you might be able to discern what's the chemical makeup of its atmosphere, or if it has one, or the nature of stuff on its surface. Now, so that's what they're actually trying to do. So they've used the Very Large Telescope, and the next step is to go to the Extremely Large Telescope to confirm whether this is actually a planet or whether it is dust. And I suppose they're doing that with good reason, because in the literature this week, NASA announced that an exoplanet that they had previously observed, a different one, and they went looking for it again with the Hubble telescope and using a slightly different technique. And they've observed that it's gone. And they have seen in it, in its wake, a big pile of dust. And they're wondering, was it always dust? Or maybe, and they've been modeling this with some precision, they might have observed a once in 200,000 year event, in that they may have observed this planet hitting another planet and the two of them annihilating each other, which would be absolutely incredible if that were the case.
When you say once in 200,000 years, you mean, I mean, obviously, like, universe is infinite. So how can that be once every 200,000 years? What are you talking about? In our solar system or in...
Oh, well, I suppose the odds of it happening for any planet would be on that order. It actually seems quite quite frequent on the galactic scale, as I read the number again, and once in 200,000 year event. That would suggest the Earth would get hit quite a lot.
Yeah.
The collisions of other planetary bodies with the Earth has been incredibly important. That's how our moon was formed. And without the moon, we wouldn't have the seasons, we wouldn't have the tides. There'd be a lot of stuff that would not happen on Earth. There certainly wouldn't be the same level of biodiversity. So when we're looking for exoplanets that might harbor life, we look for exomoons, but we haven't discovered or observed any yet. But there are some tentative signs that we may be beginning to see exomoons, which is incredible. A dot around a star in a distant part of the sky.
Lara, your story is about a toad that has come about from IVF. I'm just wondering... Why we would do something like that, or why is that important?
So yeah, this is a lovely story that's come from the Fort Worth Zoo, which is in Texas. And there's a lady there, Diane Barber, who's very interested in amphibians. Approximately 40% of amphibians at the moment are actually at imminent risk of extinction. They're very, very vulnerable to habitat loss, climate change, and also fungal diseases. So we need to be really worried about our amphibians. And a lot of people aren't, because they're not as cute as mammals. And Diane Barber is. So what she started doing is producing this Puerto Rican crested toad from IVF. And it's the first time that it's ever been produced from IVF from frozen semen. And it's really important because it means then you can go into the wild, you can find these toads, and you can take semen samples, and you can introduce them into the captive toad in the zoo. And it means you can get a lot of genetic diversity. So I kind of love how they did it. The researchers went out into the wild and they captured 6 Puerto Rican crested toads. And what they did was they injected them with hormones, and then they barked at them to scare them. And when they scare them, they urinate, and their urine contains their semen. So these researchers barked at these poor little toads, and then they got samples of their semen and they brought them back and they froze them. And subsequently then, obviously, all of the
Sorry, no, hang on a second.
We're just going to skip past it.
Yeah, no, we don't get to do that on this program. Why didn't they just use a syringe to extract the semen from the testes?
Well, it's actually much easier to just let them pee, because then it's already out in the atmosphere and you can just collect it up very easily. So it's far less invasive for these animals. And they wanted to re-release them because they're already
an endangered
species. So they did inject them with the hormones, in fairness. But then it's, you can inject them kind of almost anywhere in the body, as opposed to having to try and find their little tiny toad testes. So I suppose that's probably why they barked at them like dogs, because they're very scared of dogs. So, I think it's quite sweet how they captured it.
It's quite ingenious. And I suppose, depending on what method you're using, it does matter where you stick it in.
It does, absolutely, yeah. I mean, I suppose...
Sorry, that was a joke, so...
Oh, sorry.
I just wanted to stop you right there in case we went any further on that one. Okay, so...
Too far.
So what happened then? These toads weed out their semen...
And then they froze it and they brought it back. And what they did was they did pretty standard IVF with an egg from a captive toad. And at this stage, both of the parents, sets of parents, the mothers and the fathers, would have been long dead. and they managed to then produce these baby toads. And the first one that hatched, they called Olaf, after the frozen snowman from Frozen, the film, because it came from frozen sperm. So that's why he's called Olaf. And what they want to do is re-release these animals into the wild. They've actually, not just this one zoo, but from a number of zoos over in the United States and Canada, they've re-released over half a million of these toads.
What?
Into the, yeah, so, because they're so badly endangered.
It's a lot of toads.
It is. It's wonderful. Fort Worth itself has released over 70,000 of these toads back into the environment in Puerto Rico. So it is. It's really amazing and really important. And it's quite interesting because this idea of biobanking, people want to, you know, clone animals that have extinct and things like that. But it's much easier if you actually just keep the sperm and the egg rather than trying to work from stem cells, because there's a lot more work involved in cloning an animal from stem cell than just using pretty standard IVF techniques. And for instance, when the very last male northern white rhino died, that essentially brought to an end the idea of the species continuing. There's still two living northern white rhino females left, but they're both past reproductive age. But they have northern white rhino sperm. So what they want to do is use these to create embryos. They've actually already created three, and to implant these into southern white rhinos as surrogate parents and yeah. bring back the northern white rhinos. So it's just quite interesting, biobanking genetic material.
Mm. Our third story, Shane, has to do with farming insects.
Yeah, so it was long thought that humans were the only species that would farm, so that we would tend to plants or other living things for our own consumption and to keep us going. But in 2016, there was reports that ants had been doing this with fungus, and that they tended to fungus and that they would keep it and eat it. And more recently, just this year, another research group has published work showing that leafcutter ants actually tend to a particular type of epiphyte, which is a plant that grows in the branches of a tree, something like a bromeliad or orchids kind of do this, so that they're not directly connected to the ground. And the plant and the ant have a great thing going on. So they basically, the plant is removed from the ground, so it isn't able to get nitrogen, which it needs to grow. And so what's happened is the ants have co-evolved with it so that they're able to enter into a part of the bulb of the plant and poo inside it. And so they bring the nitrogen, and this helps the plant to grow. Now, that kind of relationship in nature is not unusual. We see that bees and flowers have co-evolved so that like a lock and key mechanism, they work for each other and both benefit from it. And that's not unusual. What's unusual here is that the ants actually plant the plant in various places to maximize the amount of sunlight it gets, such that they get the sweetest produce from the plant, and that's good for their food. And so they'll defend it vigorously from predators. They really will take care of it. And so this is said by the researchers to be a sort of insect farming, in inverted commas.
These particular ants, where are they found?
So these plants are found in the tropics. And so the particular plant, as I said, it's an epiphyte. So it grows in the branches of a tree and it's not connected to the ground. And that's the important bit here, because they need the ants to bring the food to them in order for them to grow. It's incredible. Very it really cute. Is. And so some rather enterprising Dutch farmers are looking at this model of how the poo from the ants is brought to the plants, and they're saying there are lessons for human farming there about how we use waste from certain creatures to grow our seeds and to grow our plants next door to them, sort of a circular economy, if you will.
Our final story, Lara, has to do with pigeons.
Yeah, this is a really cute little story, just a short one, and it's part of this growing field that's called urban evolution, where people are studying not, you know, these fascinating animals in the wild like elephants and tigers and things, but they're actually looking at urban animals. So for instance, in Ireland, foxes; over in the States, they'd be looking at raccoons. And this story is about pigeons. And this lady went out in the whole eastern seaboard of the United States, and she captured all of these pigeons. So she threw a net out, she captured pigeons, and she took blood samples to try and see the interconnectedness of them. And what she found is that all the way up the eastern seaboard, so from Philadelphia all the way up to New York, pigeons are one megalopolis, is what she calls it. So it's one interconnected subspecies of pigeons, but they are completely different to the pigeons in Boston. So they're all the same species, but they don't interbreed. And the funny thing is, the reason they don't is because there's a big green space between New York and Boston. There's less than 200 miles between them, but there's a huge green space. And the pigeons are probably too scared to fly over it because there's no lights there. It's not what they're used to, and it's not a city space. So the Boston and the New York pigeons, they just don't mix.
Wow. That's pretty cool, isn't it?
And, it is cool.
And it is unusual, I suppose, over such a long distance not to experience differences in species or subspecies. The fact that they're such a successful bird that they've managed to basically colonize with one single species the entire eastern coast of America. I mean, it tells us everything we already knew.
Yeah, but I mean, I think it's fascinating because they're interbreeding for hundreds and hundreds of miles, but it's all cityscape. And then as soon as there's a little green space, they just are too scared to cross it. It's not what they're used to. And Boston pigeons are this little kind of subspecies unto themselves. So they probably think they're a lot better than everyone else.
That's a theory. I'm not entirely convinced by that.
It's a theory. It's a theory. I like it, though.
I like it, too. Screw it. Why not?
And we don't have to peer review things anymore. So we can say whatever we want.
All right.
Yeah, exactly. Drink the bleach.
No, do not drink, inject, or do anything with bleach other than wash your toilets. And even do that sparingly, because really you don't need to do that so much. Dr. Shane Bergen, Dr. Laura Dungan, thank you very much for joining us.
Thanks, Jonathan.
Now, when we think of our favorite story, our favorite book, our favorite movie, our favorite song, the reason we love it so much is because it made us feel. And when you pare it down, the promise of story itself is just emotion. And we seek out emotion as human beings everywhere we go. Why is that? Why are emotions so important? And why do they drive us to do crazy things? Well, our next guest may be able to shed some light on it. Her name is Lauren Readers. She's a professor in the Department of Integrative Biology at the University of Wisconsin. Lauren, you're welcome to the program.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
So what exactly is an emotion? Do we have a strict definition for that? And how many can we pin down?
Yeah, you already introduced this very well. It is something that is very difficult to define. So I'll try to define it maybe on a basic physiological level. But if you look at across vertebrates, so from humans to fish, birds, rodents, there is strong evidence that we all share core primary emotional systems that involve similar brain networks and similar neurochemicals. These systems underlie emotions, and really the specific labels will differ depending on the researcher, but the labels would include things that you're really familiar with, such as joy, sadness, anger, fear. Some people add anticipation to that list. And these emotional responses coordinate behavior to promote survival or reproduction across vertebrates. And they can be positive, so an animal will repeat a behavior. So for example, a foraging bear, if it finds a patch of berries, that might evoke joy, and the bear then will return to that spot. Or emotional responses can be negative. And so this would ensure that an animal will avoid a particular situation. So if a bird is attacked by a cat at a bird feeder, later that bird is going to avoid that particular feeder. So because these emotions are regulated by core systems across vertebrates, it's proposed that by studying emotions in animals, we can learn about human behavior, and that what we find can be used to alleviate mental health conditions such as depression or anxiety.
I mean, when I think about emotion, and I think about the times I feel strong emotion, they're the times you really remember. And I talk about communications and why story is so important in my job. And one of the things I keep coming back to is this idea that the things that make us feel the most are the things we remember best. And I often ask a crowded room to raise their hands if they remember a time when they were under the age of 10 and someone made them feel ashamed or really sad or really angry. And people can remember not only that person, where they were standing, what they were wearing, the exact words that was said, what happened next, an amazing amount of clarity from that moment of feeling a strong emotion. And yet they may have met a barista the week before and gotten a latte from them, seen their face. And because they didn't have that emotional reaction, they didn't record it. And I wonder, is there good evidence to tie emotion to memory and survival learnings? Is there anything that ties those two things together?
Yes, definitely. I mean, I already mentioned examples of, you know, if an animal has a positive experience in a certain environment, it will remember that environment. It will return back to that environment. It develops a preference for that particular place. And that's adaptive, right? Because it's important to find food, right, for survival. Or maybe even more important are the negative emotions that you mentioned, you know, feeling ashamed or some fearful response. Maybe even more important that you avoid certain situations. So if you're threatened or you're in a situation in which you experience danger, it's important to stamp in that emotional experience with the place, you know, so you can avoid that place or that situation. And definitely, we may talk later about some of the neurochemicals involved in emotion. One that comes to mind, and a lot of people are familiar with, would be dopamine. And dopamine is important for reward-directed behaviors. It's also critical for stamping in relationships between an experience and a certain situation or certain stimuli. So emotions definitely are important for shaping our behaviors so that we do things that are appropriate so that we can survive.
Whereabouts in our brain do we see lighting up when we experience emotions? Presumably people have been in MRI and been shown disgusting images, and I'm wondering, are all emotions flaring up in the same part of the brain, and is that one of the older parts of our brain?
Right. So it is proposed that we have really a core basic neural system that's regulating emotions, and that this is something that's shared across vertebrates, meaning that even though vertebrates have been evolving for many years, for example, birds and mammals diverged from a common ancestor over 300 million years ago, but what we still are experiencing very similar emotions. And if you look at the brains of a bird or a mammal, you see very similar brain regions are active when they're experiencing kind of basic emotions like rage or fear, seeking kind of expectancy type behaviors, or joy. And so the idea is that this is an ancient core conserved circuit that's regulating emotions. And when you look at the brain, you see distinct patterns of activity. If an animal is experiencing something that's positive and invoking maybe a joyful or happy state, and a different set of brain regions seems to be activated when you're looking at animals experiencing a negative affective state. And so there are many brain regions. If you're looking at positive emotional states, people tend to talk about this pathway from the ventral tegmental area to the nucleus accumbens. When you talk about negative affective states, commonly people are talking about the septum and amygdala, but there actually is a lot of overlap, right? As you can imagine, it's a complex system.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things you don't mention there is the prefrontal cortex, that thinking part of the brain, the rational brain that because of its complexity and size, separates us from other mammals. And I'm wondering, is that why we see a sort of emotion on a sort of an opposing scale to rational thought? And I know the Myers-Briggs personality scale sort of has, if you're doing it, if you want a personality check, you are somewhere on the scale from thinking to feeling, which I think is a really illustrative a point of how psychologists think emotion and thinking are the opposite things.
That's true. People often think that you have to like really work hard to tamp down your emotions and that the prefrontal cortex may play an important role in this. So yeah, I think the two systems interact. You experience this emotion, and I think over time, through learning and having different experiences, you learn how to react to that emotion. There can be positive and socially appropriate ways to respond to an emotion, and obviously there can be sort of socially inappropriate ways. And so I think that the two systems do compete to an extent, and that it's important that, you know, as a human functioning society anyway, we learn to tamp down emotions. But even in animals, non-human animals, I'm thinking of an example of, there are studies looking at birds performing elaborate courtship displays. So this is a male, he's highly sexually motivated, and this sexual motivation is sometimes described as a critical and core emotion. But even those males, when they're courting, They have to modify their courtship displays in response to females, right? So there are multiple brain regions active, even in animals, you know, including birds, where they have to use sort of more cognitive thinking brain areas to kind of adjust these basic, you know, these behaviors that would be generated by more emotional states so that they can function effectively in their environment.
I found it really interesting that you said that we see different parts of the brain activated for positive and different for negative. And I'm wondering why those, I mean, in psychology studies, those are lumped together very often, negative feelings and positive feelings. But rage is very different, of course, to fear. They're both negative emotions, but they are in some ways the opposite, you would imagine. Lust or, you know, overactive lust is very different to rage. Is there a reason why we call these negative emotions? Do they overlap very much? Is there just negative and positive emotions?
Right. I think, you know, there are gradations. And some of the idea that, you know, there are these positive and negative emotions, I mean, it's very simple. You've got good and you've got bad. That's pretty easy. But I'm thinking right now about some early approaches that were used to ask non-human animals how they're feeling. And those approaches sometimes involved actually turning what they refer to as turning on emotions in animals. So they would stimulate using electrodes specific brain areas, and they would ask an animal, does it feel good or bad? And so you can you can ask the animal. So you let the animal answer this question by giving it the option of turning on or off the stimulation, so by pushing a lever. And what researchers found, and these are early studies in the 70s, is that animals would turn off the stimulation of the brain sites that caused distress-type vocalizations, suggesting that these were negative experiences.
Right.
And then they also found that rodents would turn on stimulation that caused positive vocalizations. And they found that these sensations or these vocalizations were stimulated by distinct brain areas. And the brain areas actually match those that underlie negative and positive emotional states in humans. So this is part of the old research that kind of built the case that we do have these core emotional systems shared across vertebrates. But it also suggested that there are some brain regions that do seem to evoke a negative affective state, some that evoke a positive affective state. But, you know, there are some animals that, you know, sometimes it was they'd stimulate brain regions that induced aggression, and it seemed like animals wanted to turn that off. But there are other studies that show aggressive behavior can be positive and rewarding. So I think it's more complicated, you know, than just good or bad or on or off.
I know there are sort of evolutionary reasons for why we feel different emotions. And I guess, you know, I think an evolutionary psychologist is often great at coming up with hypotheses, but one of those that I thought was particularly good was this recalibration theory of anger, and the idea that when you get angry at someone, what you're trying to show is that you're annoyed that they don't feel the same about the thing that you're getting angry about as you do. And the recalibration theory sort of says, by getting angry at them, you're sort of trying to adjust them to care as much as you do about something. So by you know, if you get cut off by someone in a car, the reason you open the door, go down to the trunk and take out a tire iron is because you want to get that person to feel about your safety as much as you do. Are there evolutionary reasons for emotions that we see maybe in animals that are easily explained, or is it a bit of a guessing game?
Well, I think it is a bit of a guessing game, but you know, your example made me think of, you know, this emotions, when you experience an emotion, you are communicating, and communication signals are designed to alter the emotional state of another individual, right? So maybe not the exact example of, I can't picture an animal, you know, getting angry and then trying to communicate that state to another animal in the same way that you've described, but there are, you know, males that are knocking themselves out performing elaborate courtship displays to try to change the motivational state of a female, right? Mm-hmm. So that she is now sexually motivated. So in a way, I do think there is something to this, and I do think it's something that can be shared across animal kingdom.
why are we sometimes such slaves to our emotions? I mean, we have this big thinking brain in our skulls, and yet rage, lust, all sorts of emotions, intense sadness sometimes take over. They are crippling to the functioning of the human being who experiences them. Why are they allowed such control over the brain in this supposedly evolved ape?
Yeah, I would say that is because the reason that they still exist today is because they're important. It's important for us to avoid things that threaten our lives. And so, you know, it can be that people perceive things that aren't extreme threats as if they are extreme threats. And so I think this can lead to, you know, anxiety and fear and sort of pathological conditions. But I think that it's difficult if you got rid of these responses, you know, we wouldn't survive, right? You would do stupid things. You could walk into traffic, right? You wouldn't avoid things that can kill you. And so I think that's critical. And if you weren't, you know, it's been very important during evolution for humans to find rich, fatty, delicious food sources, right? That evokes a very positive emotional state. Hmm. And that's critical for survival, right? We need, if you were, you know, a long time ago, you ran across something that was rich, delicious, and fatty, that would be a good thing to consume. And so I think these emotions, they're so built in because they help us survive. They help us reproduce, pass our genes to the next generation. And so sometimes I do think, you know, we can misinterpret signals in the environment, perceive them as more serious than they are. And I think that's when sometimes this can lead to, you know, dysregulated conditions.
You've done research into social isolation, right?
To an extent. And we did that. We weren't intending to do that, but that is some of the way that we've reinterpreted some of our studies on songbirds to tell us a little bit about why it is painful to be socially isolated.
So tell me how exactly you researched something like that in birds.
All right. So this area of my research, first of all, I do think it can shed some light on how we're feeling during this time of social distancing. We are studying social behaviors in starlings. So starlings, you know, they're these songbirds. Ornithologists might flinch a little bit because they are often considered pest species. But starlings, they are incredibly gregarious. They're very social. They form these impressive large flocks in fall and winter, and you may be familiar with them. They're known as murmurations. And if you look online at famous videos of these starling flocks, a lot of them are actually filmed in Ireland. So I think some people are probably pretty familiar with these flocks. And what you notice in these flocks is that if a bird strays from the flock, it almost appears that it's desperate to return. And what you also observe is that if they're not flying around, when they're in these flocks, these starlings are singing. And over the years, my lab members and I have become really interested in the emotional state that birds are experiencing while in these flocks. And so if you think about humans, I mean, we're incredibly gregarious. We love to stick together. I mean, in this time of social isolation, being apart is really difficult. It requires law enforcement, basically, to keep us apart. And so there's evidence that, you know, we hang out because it feels good. But another reason that humans tend to spend time together is because it hurts to be alone. Right? Being alone is painful. Hmm. And so we wondered if this might also be the case for birds. And so in papers on birds, different authors, they compare this gregariousness or this drive to be with others. They compare it to a hunger or a craving. And in this time of social isolation, you're probably experiencing this now. You know, kind of a state of agitation or discomfort in the absence of social contact. So it hurts to be isolated. And it turns out that the brain mechanisms that underlie physical pain, they also underlie social pain. And this is supported by brain imaging studies in humans, and also by the fact that treatments that are used to reduce physical pain, so treatments that induce analgesia, they also reduce social pain. So this would include things like morphine. Morphine is an opioid. If you're injured, you can go to the hospital, your feet receive morphine, and it induces analgesia and also makes you feel good, right? Induces a positive affective state. I've even found a study that showed that acetaminophen, so paracetamol, which we know induces analgesia. It also, in a study, was shown to reduce social pain, the pain of rejection in humans.
Yeah, and the idea, although this is not something anyone should do, you don't self-prescribe yourself medicine, but I think I remember that, I think I interviewed the author on it, they were saying that actually taking painkillers after a bad breakup does make you feel emotionally better, because physical and emotional pain come from similar places, which is a striking finding. Speaking to you there, you just reminded me of an interview we did with a guy called Dr. Kip Williams, who created the Cyberball program to mimic isolation and see what it's like to be rejected. And I'm wondering, I'm wondering if you could ever use that for birds. Could you find a way to get birds to play Cyberball and see what it felt like for a starling to be sort of ignored by the rest of its flock and measure emotion that way? I think there's a few methodology challenges there, but it could be quite an interesting experiment.
I think it would be a great idea. You know, we do have some data actually that would speak to that just a little bit, where we wanted to ask birds if it feels good to sing. And we were looking at starlings, it was males singing to attract females. And we did not think that the act of singing in this case would be rewarding, but we thought that if a male attracts a female and he copulates, of course, that's going to be rewarding.
Yeah.
Of course, copulation has been shown to be rewarding in other animals. No one would doubt that. But in this study, the males were singing, and we didn't put them together long enough with the females for them to copulate. But we did see that some males attracted females. They were singing from these nest boxes. And some males attracted the females. And some males did not attract the females. They were rejected. And so what we did is, after they were singing, we associated the singing with a distinct environment. So, for example, some birds were singing. We'll just simplify this. We'll say they were singing in a blue environment when they were trying to attract a female. And later what we found is that males that were singing to attract to females that were not rejected, they did not prefer blue or green. We gave them two choices. But birds that were rejected, if they were singing and then we put them in the blue environment after they had been rejected by a female, they avoided that blue environment. And that suggests that rejection was painful, you know, even for these starlings, which I think is interesting.
And so when these birds get back to their flock, if they're reintroduced or re-welcomed back into a flock, do we know if they feel less pain, if that pain is alleviated?
Well, we actually tested this. And what we were actually interested at the time was finding out if opioids were released when birds were singing. Opioids are known to be involved in reward, but they also induce analgesia. And so, so we wanted to see, I mean, our prediction was that if being part of a flock and socializing in that flock reduced social pain, we predicted it might also reduce physical pain. It might induce analgesia. And so a little background, because I think this is kind of interesting, but there are studies in humans that show that vocal behaviors can induce analgesia. So for example, social laughter induces analgesia, swearing induces analgesia, and usually they measure this by asking humans to hold their hand, for example, in cold water. And if they can tolerate the cold, that means they're experiencing analgesia. So if you swear more, you can actually keep your hand in cold water longer. And you can try this at home. But we decided to try a similar test to see if singing in flocks and starlings might induce analgesia. And so we modified the test a little. We used hot water because that test had been used previously in songbirds. So the water's not too hot. It's mildly aversive. We'd stick our finger in there, no problem. But we let the birds sing in the large, gregarious flocks. And we found that birds that sing at high rates could keep a foot in hot water longer than the low singers. So this suggests that socializing in flocks does reduce pain. And I want to highlight that this measure of analgesia has been shown in birds and other animals to be opioid sensitive. So using this indirect measure of opioid release, we think it suggests that opioids are reducing the pain of rejection. You put birds back in a flock, this reduces opioids, and they experience a positive emotional state.
Wow. So you got some birds and went to see how long they could keep their feet in hot water, and found that the ones that sang released a sort of painkiller and an opioid into their brain that reduced the pain of the hot water, and they could keep their feet in there longer. That is just such a, it's one of those experiments you expect to hear on the Ig Nobels, but fascinating.
Yeah. And we didn't, you know, we were just looking for an indirect measure of opioid release at the time. But later when we thought about the data, we thought, you know, this is interesting. This suggests that when you are joining the flock, you're back in your social situation, that you're releasing opioids. And that's probably part of what bonds you to your flock.
Can we extrapolate to humans on that?
Yeah. You know, I think that in this case, by studying birds, we do have some insight into the pain of social distancing, right, and the pleasures associated with social contact. So I think the Starling studies are suggesting that basically during this time of social distancing, we are deprived of endogenous opioid release. And I should add, there are other neuromodulators too. It's not likely there's one neuromodulator that's going to affect a single emotion. So this would include oxytocin, dopamine, and other neurochemicals. But I think that in humans right now, you may find yourself seeking other ways to acquire natural rewards. So normally social interactions would lead to endogenous opioid release, but now we are deprived. So you may find yourself in the pantry searching for sweets, which can release opioids.
Get out of my mind.
That's right. But there, you know, there are other ways.
I just ate a biscuit. I just had a biscuit a second ago.
I know. And I'm finding myself in the kitchen all the time now. I've developed a place preference, you know.
Yeah. And my wife is just running all the time, and I'm not sure that she's getting out of the house, staying away from us, but also that, you know, that sort of runner's high that she's getting.
Yeah.
Really interesting. Lauren Readers from the University of Wisconsin, thanks very much for your time.
Thank you.
It's time to look back at some of your comments from last week, and Simon from Dublin 3 is commenting on the opening discussion we had about COVID. So he says, while the efforts of people to repress the spread of the virus are indeed admirable, surely we can't continue as we're in the absence of a vaccine. And if a vaccine doesn't arrive for a year, 2 years, or ever, what then? We can't stay locked in our houses for the rest of our lives. We'll slow the spread of coronavirus but destroy our society. The virus is still out there whenever we do emerge from this unsustainable lockdown, and immunity will be non-existent. How do you think we should manage the loosening of the lockdown? Surely we can't stay here indefinitely. Will there become a tipping point when deaths from postponed surgeries, chemo, dialysis, etc., outstrip death from COVID-19? It's a really tricky one. It's a major decision by the government to figure out what it is that we need to do. If we think about this last number of weeks, a huge amount of science has been done, a huge amount of research. We've ruled out some things. We've understood some things better. We're in a much better place in terms of understanding the disease. While there still are some questions answered, one of the big ones to figure out is how many get the virus once they have been cleared of it. And that, of course, is going to be a big question. If we understand that, then I think we have we can put in place some logical steps to start releasing the people from their lockdown. Of course, the whole point of flattening the curve, the whole point of this is that when we have a flu, it doesn't happen all at once in a single wave. And this particular virus is so virulent, it was so prevalent, and it seemed to have much more severe effects, that the whole point of keeping people in is just getting through that first wave and almost clearing the hospitals of the peak of beds that are required. And as you slowly release people back into the population, yes, there will still be coronavirus patients. Some will be hospitalized, some will die. But those patients will get good quality care. What you don't want is military trucks piling up bodies to put into the ground in unmarked graves, which we see in some countries, which is you know, one of those images you never really think you're going to see in your own lifetime. Once we feel that the health system can take an increase of patients, absolutely, I think we need to look at changing our measures. I think social distancing is going to stick around for a long time, and I think the Taoiseach and Simon Harris have said as such. We were also talking about screen time last week and the impact of screen time. Someone says, what was the study about screens called? As a teacher, I've seen huge change in language skills of children coming into school from 2015. I couldn't figure it out. I thought for a while it could possibly have been the swine flu vaccine, but they kept coming year on year. Then the penny dropped. Smartphones proliferated around 2010. I'd love to see a study on that. Or did that study cover this? So I don't think that study covered the required period for us to look at children now. It seemed to me it finished just a little bit too late, just when iPads had been invented as opposed to in every home, which is probably, you know, 4 or 5 years later is when it started. And I suppose it being something that the kids could play with was probably another year or two after that. This study doesn't reach that. And I think the change in technology and our relationship to technology has absolutely been overturned in the last 5 years. So I don't know whether or not that affects language. I don't know. But I do know that the biggest change has happened in the last half decade, and this study didn't cover it. But it did say that kids spending time on screens were just as social as those who weren't. Philip and Lucan said, the Emperor of Scent by Chandler Burr is a great read about Turin's journey. This is on the science of scent. I haven't read that yet. This was a piece we did last week, a really interesting interview about how the nose smells. And the prevailing theory is that it's the shape of the molecules that somehow fit like a key and lock into sensors in the nose. We spoke to Luca Turin himself, who proposed this different theory that, in fact, it's not the shape of molecules, but it is the shape, it is the vibration frequency that the brain senses and gives different smells to. And he says one of the proofs of this is that some molecules that are totally different shapes but have the same frequency smell similar. It sounded convincing to me, but then I'm not a neurologist. So I kind of really want him to be right, but you always want the underdog to be right. But it'd be interesting to see how that pans out. Fascinating interview if you missed it last week. Pori Crinlin says, twice while playing on a windy day of golf, a fellow player said to me, there's a fox somewhere down there. I can smell him on the wind. He wasn't bluffing. It was a clear fairway, and we were talking about 75 metres plus. Well, some people have this ability to sense much greater than the average, and I am not one of those. I can't smell or identify, you know, my favorite dish if I close my eyes in front of me. And Shane Bergen, our Newsround panelist, was sort of implying that we don't really pay attention to things once we've done them once. And he said, you know, Jonathan, who was the third man on the moon? And of course, everyone knows Neil Armstrong, Buzz Aldrin, and in the orbiting module was Michael Collins. But the third person, as Joe Cuddy says, he had to Google as soon as he heard the sentence. It was Charles Pete Conrad. So Charles, lest we forget, my apologies. That's it from us for this week. Hope you enjoyed the show. We will be doing a COVID-19 Q&A because there seems to be demand for that. Although I've got a bit of COVID fatigue at the moment. I know there's been a few scientific questions, and I suppose we are the show to answer those. So we're going to see if we can do a short episode in the podcast feed. So look out for that if you're interested in digging deeper to some of these stories that we're hearing in the news. Thanks to Aidan McKelvey, who was producing, Simon Keane researching, Jojo Cardozo was on sound. We'll be back with more in your podcast feed on Tuesday. Look forward to that. In the meantime, stay curious.